Welcome to today's episode of the Ideanomics podcast, where we talk about inclusion, diversity. Welcome to today's episode of the Ideanomics podcast, where we talk about inclusion, diversity, equity, accessibility, and anti-racism in the Canadian Public Service. I'm your host, Marcela Popovich, joining you from Winnipeg, Treaty One lands, the original territories of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji Cree, Dakota, Lakota, Dene peoples, and the homeland of the Red River Métis. Our guest today is Alfonso Ralph Mendoza Manolo, who's in his final year as an undergraduate student at the University of Toronto, majoring in co-op public policy and global Asia studies. He's currently on exchange at the National University of Singapore, where he's joining us from today. Prior to his exchange, he worked as an equity, diversity, and inclusion policy advisor and as an ad hoc race-based data collection policy advisor for the RCMP. And actually, it's in this capacity that I heard Alfonso speak at an Ask Me Anything Courageous Conversations event. And I do want to give a little quick shout out to that group who's done a tremendous amount of work in creating a public service platform where stories and lived experiences are shared by public servants. So welcome, Alfonso.
Thank you so much, Marcela. It's a pleasure to be here.
It took a while for us to connect. As I said earlier, you're in Singapore, I'm in Winnipeg, and the timing was, we couldn't get the timing right. So thank you so much for being here.
It's okay, Marcela. It's better late than never.
So I'm going to just dive right in and I'm going to ask you, because I'm so curious, how is it like, how did your journey take you there?
Okay, that's a really good question. It's so my background is I'm Filipino-Canadian. And so that Philippines is part of a geographic region called Southeast Asia. And I was really, really interested in learning more about Southeast Asia as a region of like in its whole entirety, given the fact that a lot of my Asian studies courses back home focus on East or South Asia, and mm-hmm. Asia's a diverse geographical region where even folks, like, even though we have lots of similarities culturally and ethnically, there are still very distinct, characteristics that make us each unique within the region. And I think I just really want to experience Southeast Asia out of the textbook and see what it was like to actually live there and understand the region holistically. So I applied, I applied last year, and I thankfully got into studying and doing exchange here in Southeast Asia. And this is something I've been wanting to do since my very first year, but because of COVID, I didn't think it was going to happen, but magically I'm here today.
Wow, that's awesome. You know, I was never brave enough to leave my city, let alone the country, to go, you know, take a chance on studying somewhere differently. And I really admire your bravery for taking that step and kind of for working for it, right? For to keep like keeping the hope alive that you were going to be able to make it to there. So one of the things that I noticed in your in the little brief bio that we were talking about a little bit about is that you're minoring in critical migration. And when I read that, I wonder, what does that mean? And is that tied at all to anti-racism work?
That's a really good question, Marcela. So critical migration studies particularly, I think what's really interesting about that field of study is that oftentimes when we think about migration, we just think about legislation, at least for me and other folks. I don't know about you working with government, but for me and other folks, I think the common public's perception is that migration is only about when someone enters the country, how they enter it, how they leave. And that's practically it. How does the government facilitate that? I think it's usually what people think. But critical migration study in its whole is you have to look at various aspects of migration. Once someone enters the country, you also have to look at, have they integrated well? Have they been supported to be, are they trying to assimilate into society? What cultural distinctions do they lose or do they gain upon being society, members of Canadian society or other societies in the world? And that ties really, really well with racism, because oftentimes countries, and in this case, since we both work, since we both work or worked for the government of Canada, I'll use Canada specifically. Countries will often use ethnic or other grounds of social determinants as a reason to control or legitimize why they're not going to let someone enter the country or fully integrate into society. So it's all tied into one. For instance, if we look at like Asians specifically, the Chinese head tax is a very good example where someone's ethnicity plays really, really well into migration in a very explicit manner. The Chinese head tax was the only head tax or the only tax imposed onto any ethnic group in the history of Canada as a nation.
Wow.
Solely on the base, yeah, and it's solely on the basis of the fact that they were Asian and are not ethnically Caucasian. And you also see that and sometimes it isn't as obvious. It isn't necessarily, like I said, related to how someone enters, but it could be related to how they integrate. So another example is when we look at job opportunities for racialized folks or being able to be promoted, the question is, how well do you actually allow someone to integrate into society if you as a government don't provide them with the necessary supports or the necessary tools or policy programs to fully allow themselves to contribute economically or to have those opportunities that other members of the populace have, right? And so like a clear example of that, and I'm sure you know about this in Marcel, given that we both work in the government, is how do I say this? Access to official language training if you want to work for the government. So lots of individuals like French and English both are official languages of Canada, but Canada is much more diverse than it was during its colonial founding, right? And so we accept a lot of these individuals from other countries, and Canada's immigration system were very explicit in terms of, with our point system on who we want to accept. And oftentimes we choose the creme of the creme of the economic elites or the working class of other countries. And yet when they're here, something like language training doesn't allow them to particularly contribute as civil servants. So a lot of our immigrants come from Asia, now Africa, and lots of these folks don't speak English and French. And oftentimes when they get here, they also don't have the necessary resources or networks to even access jobs in the civil service. So I think I really enjoy your question of what the interplay is between critical migration studies and racism, because the two are intertwined, and if I were to boil it down, it's how well you allow someone to integrate and contribute to society.
You know, that's interesting, Alfonso, because I think about my own parents who were immigrants in the mid 70s, and basically the story that I grew up with was is that they had to leave where they were coming from. It was a coup d'etat in Chile, and essentially they came here and to basically work in the factories. That was the only option available for them, is Winnipeg was booming at the time. There was a ton of factory work needed, in sewing, in the sewing factories for my mom, and in kind of the more laborious factories for my dad. And that's where they ended up. And my mom had a master's degree in mathematics. And she was becoming a teacher and a professor in that. So it's kind of interesting because in that time, they had no, my mom always tells me they had no support. So it's interesting that, how many decades later, and we're still talking about the same issues, right?
Yeah, and what's interesting, Marcel, is that like, how do I say it? Sometimes, have you ever heard of the perpetual foreigner stereotype?
No.
So would you like to hear more about it,
Yes.
Marcel?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that one, I believe that one really arose out of Asian American literature, but it applies to quite a lot of ethnic groups where oftentimes an immigrant, if you're visibly racialized, no matter what you do, the public's perception of you is that you aren't, how do I say this? You aren't Canadian enough, or
Okay.
you're not Canadian. So whenever someone asks you, like, where are you from? And you say something like, I'm from Winnipeg. But deep down, the question is, where are you really from? So oftentimes, for quite a lot of racialized individuals, you're perpetually considered a foreigner, even if your ancestors have been here on this land for multiple generations. And that can be really, really hard. And I think that ties in with so many ethnic groups because oftentimes lots of ethnic groups have had a long, long history in Canada, and yet they're still not viewed as quote unquote Canadian enough. And I think that's really, really interesting. I feel like, for instance, I can't speak on behalf of your parents and their lived experiences in Canada, Marcella, but I know in the States, for quite a lot of his like Latinx and Hispanic individuals, that like they've been in America for quite some time, and yet they're still not viewed as American enough, nor are they given the same support as other citizens are. And I think that's what's so eye-opening for quite a few individuals is to see that, wow, like no matter what you do, I'm not considered American or Canadian. And what's really hard is, and I'm sure you might be able to relate to this, Marcella, is that when you're growing up as a child of immigrant parents, you tend to have this internal identity struggle within you, even if it's on a very micro level, where you have to ask yourself, okay, what parts of my culture am I able to show? And what parts of my culture do I have to sacrifice in order to fully be considered as quote unquote Canadian enough?
And it's and it can be as simple as our the pronunciation of our names, right? Like we that's such an easy thing that so many of us let go, I think, as we grow up, you know, like you said, as child of immigrants.
And what's really interesting about that as well is that, you know, as a child, you often don't question your parents. Like you just you accept what they say. And but also I didn't realize until I did my own further work that immigrants themselves, it's hard because in order to be fully integrated into society, in some ways they comply with various aspects of colonial mentality. So for instance, like colonial mentality can be broken up into three distinct stages. And one of them is not questioning the systems in place. And you can see that in something as simple as this, Marcella. And I just want you to picture that you're a child hearing this from their parents. And your parents are telling you, like, anak, anak in Filipino is like my child. It's like, anak, you have tan skin. Whatever you do, you're going to be viewed as Filipino. So you need to work harder than everybody else just to be at an equal standing. And I'm sure you can hear that line across various ethnic groups in various languages. And it's really hard because in that step of colonial mentality, you've acknowledged the fact that there is a racial hierarchy in play. But as an immigrant or as a member of a minority group, you don't want to challenge that yet because you're afraid of the repercussions. And then the second one is, and I don't know if you could feel it in your own lived experiences, Marcella, but defensive othering. So in some groups, for instance, for Asian Canadians, oftentimes we hear the word FOB or fresh off the boat. And fresh off the boat was used especially when lots of Southeast Asian immigrants came following the Vietnam War and during the Cold War when they were coming in to North America and other how do I say this, Commonwealth countries. And so fresh off the boat is when someone says like, oh, you're straight up from X immigrant country. I'm not like you. Even though we both might be Vietnamese or Cambodian or Hmong, or in your case, Marcella, even if we're both Latinx or Chilean or Argentinian, we're not the same. And that's what defensive othering is. It's when I use a label and say, okay, we're both of the same ethnic group, but you're different. So the stereotypes apply to you, but it doesn't apply to me. And we can see that oftentimes with lots of immigrants, like immigrant children, where they'll, how do you say this, they'll disassociate purposefully with other members of their ethnic group just to fit in.
Yeah,
And
I absolutely remember doing that myself when I was like around high school, and there was like an influx of Central Americans arriving in Winnipeg, and I remember thinking it, I remember even thinking that, like the doing the fob thing, Alfonso. So it's okay. Yeah. So, and there's a third one. I know there's a third aspect.
It's the third one's a bit more, it's the third one's a bit more straightforward, but the third one's more like just accepting colonialism as a beneficial thing that happened to your country. So for instance, like I'm Filipino, so the Philippines has been colonized for more than 3 centuries. More than 3 centuries by the Spanish, then the Japanese, then the Americans for around 40 to 50 years, and then the Japanese, and then the Americans again. And so sometimes you'll hear someone say that colonialism was ultimately beneficial for the country, or it's a good thing that we have racial hierarchies in place. It's different from the first stage, because in the first stage you acknowledge it, you don't challenge it. But in the third one, you embrace and promote colonialism. And I think that's such an interest when I learned about all these concepts in my one of my sociology classes back at university, it was eye-opening. Really see how it plays in real life.
Well, for sure. And then you start thinking about, and and you for sure would know, because you're in the co-op public policy, how that seeps into our public service, right? Because we're the public service is made up of human beings who are, children of immigrants or not children of immigrants, right? Like, or but it's interesting. And so what impact does that have on the public service, Alfonso?
Oh, that's a really good question. So I know I think defensive othering is the one I see most often. Like it's the most visible. And people oftentimes during their meetings at employee networks for various ethnic groups, you'll hear that a common struggle is that they don't know where the fine line is between how much they can bring themselves to work culturally. And hear words like how Asian or Black or Latinx or Arab or Indigenous can I be without facing repercussions word. And oftentimes at defensive othering, you can hear it with microaggressions where you can comment on someone's accent or the way that they dress or their particular interests, or you can even see it sometimes in terms of like where someone graduates, like their school. You can use various ways to distinguish themselves. And I think in public service, it's hard because we still haven't reached full parity for all ethnic groups in terms of representation, especially at the managerial and senior executive public service. So when you don't have that proper network, you tend to hide yourself a lot at work just to be accepted. And that Yeah, and it plays not only with ethnic groups, Marcella, but it plays with other communities as well. Like, for instance, I'm openly gay, so sometimes you also have to ask yourself, like, how much of myself can I bring to work as a gay man without facing repercussions at the RCMP specifically?
So let's explore that actually, Alfonso, because I was just gonna go, I was gonna shift the conversation a little bit to that piece. Like, so you ended up working for the RCMP, and so yeah, like how was that experience? How did you end up there? And then how did you build space to make your voice heard?
Oh, that's okay. Oh, that's a very loaded question. I think in terms of I remember I had to start applying for my co-op internship, and I knew from the get-go I wanted to work in either like consulting or the federal government or provincial. It was because municipal politics wasn't my specialty, so I didn't want to how do you say it, explore that avenue yet. But I remember seeing the job posting for the RCMP, and my first job at the time was an information management research assistant for the information management policy section. And I remember telling my friends, like, oh, I don't think they're ever going to hire a bubbly, like, gay Filipino. But I'm just gonna apply anyways. Like, it wasn't my envision of what an individual working for the police was gonna be like. I didn't think I fit in that role. And I told all my friends, like, I'll apply anyways. Like, let's see, like, if they like surprise me. And surprisingly, they did. And at the time, how do I say this? I entered the interview with the thought that you're not gonna get the job anyways. So we might as well get information like out of this. And at the time, it was the rise of anti-Asian hate, or I would like to explicit anti-Asian hate. So, and a lot of my work revolved around multiculturalism and racism and discrimination in general. So I was very curious to see what the police, the RCMP specifically, were doing to combat it. And I asked the two, my manager and supervisor at the time, who were interviewing me, what were you doing in terms of information management to track these cases? And how do you implement race when it comes to collecting information? How do you collect race-based data? And I didn't know at the time that they were working on that initiative. And yeah, and those questions are what got me the job down the line. And it's funny enough because the job has really taught me to be a more assertive, which has been a struggle on its own because, growing up, you're as children of immigrant parents, they always tell you, like, put your head down, just do the work, someone will recognize you, like just put your head down, do the work, and believe that you're doing good. But I wasn't raised to challenge anything. And funny enough, Marcella, every time I challenge something at the RCMP, that's when my career luckily progressed. And each time I did it, I walked away with the thought of, I'm gonna get fired. Like, at least at least I leave fulfilled. Like, I remember, like, when I was still working that the research assistant job for the IMPS at RCMP, I was part of the race-based data collection working group, and we had an audio call across the whole, I think, across all of Canada. And at the time, I was still an intern until the very end, but I would hear certain individuals say things that didn't sit right with me. And for instance, the meeting at the time was if we were going to collect, the meeting agenda at the time was if you're going to collect race-based data that was perception-based or self-identification-based. We were going to collect the data either way because it was legislated mandated by Parliament, but the question was what research methods you're going to employ. And I remember one of the participants in the call explicitly, I think I was just so shocked. They explicitly said, how do you expect me to write down my perception of someone's race when for the life of me, I cannot tell if the new guy in my office is Indian, Black, or Indigenous for the life of me. I was so shocked. Like, I was like, wow. And it's, I think it continuously got worse because the person later on said, oh, also, how do you expect me to collect self-identification-based data if, as a police officer on the field, when I used to ask racialized individuals if they were racialized, they would say no. And so, how do you expect me to trust a racialized individual or an Indigenous individual to say that they're a visible minority when they don't want to admit themselves at the hand of the police? And at the time, it was nearing the end of my internship. And I was like, oh, Fonzo, this is your time to challenge it. Because I really thought that my contract wasn't going to be renewed. So I told them, like, the reason why we need to collect perceptions-based data is to see if your interaction with an individual changes based off of your perception of their race. And that's It was very important at the time because this was after the George Floyd protests in 2020. So we needed to use it to see if various ethnic groups were subject to a disproportionate amount of force on the basis that they were visibly how it says, members of a visible minority. And also I had to tell them that, it would, how do you say this? It would be beneficial if, as a police officer, you try to empathize with the individual and understand that they're probably working under the premise that if the police officer knows that they're racialized, they will probably be subject to even more marginalization or disproportionate uses of force. So it, I said, it, I think police officers at the time were just hearing that comment. I was just shocked to not see that the individual, or there was still such a strong culture of that lack of cultural understanding. And not,
And I mean, for you to, like you said, to it's it wasn't a, it's not a norm, right? To kind of I know I grew up not questioning people in authority. That was part of like my growing up, and I can understand the struggle and the kind of like that you have to kind of like really think to yourself, okay, I'm gonna do this. And like you said, you're gonna challenge, you're gonna lead, this is gonna be your moment. And I'm assuming that you got and I'm assuming you got extended from what you didn't say
It ended up working out. Like, I know in some, for most people, first, quite a lot of people, it doesn't always work out when you challenge authority. I was very lucky where the moderator for that working group ended up calling my manager at the time. And my manager at the time said, like, "Oh, Alfonso, I heard you said some very interesting things at the meeting." But luckily, the moderator I didn't know was a manager, and he was hiring for his for the the new equity, diversity, inclusion unit. And that me challenging authority led to that new job where I got to really, just implement and enact changes in the RCMP. Even though I was just a student intern, like, I was really grateful, and I'm still really grateful to be have given the opportunity to have such an impactful role. Like, within that role, Marcella, I've been able to do so many things that I dreamed of. Like, I got to author the anti-Asian racism sub-module in our anti-racism course in the RCMP, which over 30,000 employees have to take. It was just such a incredible experience, even though it was very difficult. It was that one I got to, how do I say this? I got to really work on to us LGBTQIA plus file, and work with the R and represent the RCMP in terms of how we're going to implement all the findings in the LGBT purge report. It's the government is such a fulfilling place to work at, even though you have to challenge certain things at time. But yeah, it's been challenging, but it's been extremely rewarding at the same time.
Well, that really warms my heart to hear, Alfonso, because I know you're not right now because you're finishing your degree. I hope one day that you're going to come back to the federal public service. But at the end of the day, all the work that everyone's doing, right, at the Anti-Racism Ambassadors Network, people who are working in this space, in the EDIA space, like, I think, want to be able to contribute in a meaningful way and make change, and move that needle forward. So I'm really happy to hear that you were able to contribute in a way that meant something to you. Speaking about the public service, and I know that you weren't you're not in the public service. Like I said, I hope one day you're going to come back to the federal public service. But if you could share with us and share with our audience, what change would you want to see in the public service? What are your hopes for the public service?
In terms of changes, it's very hard to narrow. It's louder. I think on the top of my head, yeah, it's very hard to choose. I think one of them really is that whenever I talk to folks who are visible minorities and are indigenous, I think a common struggle really is the official language training. I think If the government was able to provide more support for that, it would, and because how do you say, even though we all work for the same public service, it doesn't mean that we have the same access to these languages on a daily basis. So someone working in Vancouver or even Winnipeg, like it could be quite hard to find a community to speak French with on a daily basis at a business capacity. And sometimes with restricting budgets, lots of federal departments have been cutting like their language services, but they still expect individuals to provide and work in both official languages, which is really difficult to do. And you know, and as and I'm sure as you know, Marcel, like it affects various public servants disproportionately because, for instance, a single income working mother or a single income working parent working for the federal government, it could be very difficult for them to take out even more money just to access this language training. And language training can take years for some this CCC, I think the CCC designation or official bilingual designation. So I think I would just really want to see more support for languages. Another one that I would want to see more support is funding for these employee networks, because so much great work is happening in the EDI space in the federal government. We have so many networks now. For instance, we have the Anti-Racist Ambassadors Network, we have the Visible Minority Champions, we have how do you say it? We also have each ethnic group also has their own individual like working associations in the government, but they don't see much funding or support from it. A lot of this work is done outside of their everyday work or on the side of their desk. And I think it's unfortunate to see that the same issues in the EDI space in the private sector are also being replicated in the public sector where they're not supported. And I think that was really hard, especially like our team at the time, we were just growing. But as you may know, like EDI is a very demanding policy sphere to work in because there's always so much work to do. There's always so much meaningful change to enact. And it was a bit debilitating at times to tell individuals like, oh, sorry, we have to prioritize other EDI files, even though yours is important at this moment. Or at the RCMP, we'd hear so much great work being done around the country, but these folks were working on the side of their desk. Nova Scotia, for instance, they facilitated a multi-day training program on the Black experience. Or out in Vancouver, out in British Columbia, we would hear of police detachments where folks who were of an Asian ethnic origin, who were working as police officers, they were trying to train and teach their other co-working police officers on cultural nuances in the Asian communities that they interact with. But all of these things are done off of the side of someone's desk. And that same issue is an issue in the private sector. It's being replicated here. I think it's quite unfortunate.
And it can be quite it like you said, it's taxing, right? It's sometimes there's very heavy issues. A lot of times it's very heavy issues that you're dealing with, and you're trying to make change. And like you said, you're working towards making a real change in the work that you're doing.
And I think it's hard to narrow it down, but I think the other one would be, I wish I saw a bit more mentorship. I think as an, I think mentorship would have been like cross-departmental mentorship or cross-departmental work in like an emphasis on collaborating between departments, Marcella, because there's so many employees in individual federal government agencies and departments. But even though we're all working on the same anti-racism work, sometimes the work can be duplicated. And as I said prior, like when you already don't have a lot of resources to invest in these networks, having any sort of information or just more people power would be so beneficial for these change makers in the federal government. And I think it's hard that we're quite siloed at times in terms of our work and even in our everyday policy work. Like sometimes I'll be looking for data, like race-based data collection, like race-based data, and I wouldn't even know that the agency next to me is working on the same file. Yeah, and I really wish that the government just sort of continued to work less siloed as a civil as a civil service.
Well, those are three very, for being put on the spot, you thought of some great answers there, Alfonso. And I'm gonna pivot a little bit, right? And it's a question that I've been wanting to ask, our guests on IDEA. And it's really around, I'm a first generation, as I've shared. You're a first generation Canadian, and I'm always curious about how much influence, if any, did your community or your parents have on your career, your study choices, and how does that role weigh in, right? Like, how do you now being the next generation, what does it mean?
That's thank you. First of all, that's a very loaded question. I think personally, I feel like someone's identity, because we all hold multiple identities, right? Like it all manifests physically in how you go on with your day in an everyday basis, including at work. So I think in terms of my community, at least my parents were very supportive of the fact that I decided to go on this career choice. But at times they were quite scared of me challenging authority, especially because cultural nuances aside, I think my parents grew up during the People Power Revolution in the Philippines under the Marcos di dictatorship. And so they grew up with folks who, if they were the political opposition, if they were activists, they would be imprisoned or they would just disappear. And they were taught to, just keep your head down because you could be the next in line if you challenge authority. And so I think every time I tell them that I'm challenging authority, they're very proud, but they always tell me to be careful. And they're proud of the fact that they tell me, like, Anak or my child, like, we're glad that you're fighting for all these communities, even communities that I don't, like, as an ally, like, even though I'm not ethnically part of some of the communities that I advocate for, you still have to find a way to mobilize with your brothers and sisters, right? Your siblings in this fight for equality. And I think my migration experience really, really taught me that you have to advocate for yourself because no one else is going to do it for you. And I think being able to do that as a career has been so fulfilling. I can't underemphasize, like overemphasize how much how fulfilling it has been. I think one thing that's quite a shame is that with that defensive othering that I mentioned earlier, I knew that no matter what career I wanted to do, I wanted to find a way that I contribute to a larger goal that I allow other individuals to be proud of themselves, regardless of what community they're in, because oftentimes we toss that identity aside just to be accepted. And I just want my community to be proud of being part of that community, to be proud that you come from an ethnic group, or to be proud of the fact that you're not straight, you're a gender or a sexual minority, or to be proud of the fact that you're a migrant, or that you're on a different side of the ability spectrum. You can be proud of the differences that you can bring into the workplace, and it isn't a detriment. And I think it's such a shame to see children grow up and you hear how much shame that they have in holding these identities. And even though my work in the government is policy-based, like where we work in behind the scenes, I think it's just so nice knowing that the work that you're doing enacts physical, plausible change that you'll see, and maybe you won't see it instantly, but you'll see the change in a few decades or so. And I think I really have to thank all the communities that I'm a part of, because I think all the cultural nuances, for instance, we have a word called bayanihan in Tagalog, and Tagalog is the national, Filipino is the national language of the Philippines. And bayanihan is the thought of, or kapwa, bayanihan kapwa, it's the thought of helping out another individual who cannot help themselves without the thought of asking for anything in return. And I think that, in essence, is the basis of policy work. Right, Marcel? Like, when you work policy, no one says thank you on a daily basis. They don't know the work that you're doing. They don't know the fight that you're going through and challenging authority. But you do it because you know that it leads to a greater goal of equality and justice. And that the word kapwa is to be able to see someone as your own, empathize. Even though you have differences, you find ways to build those bridges. And when you build those bridges and empathize, it's easier to be an ally. It's so much easier to be an ally because you remember the fact that even though we have distinct migration experiences or distinct forms of racial discrimination against us, the fact of the matter is we're all just striving for equality and acceptance at the end of the day. And it helps. It really helps when you have those misunderstandings. So just remember that, because EDI work can be very, it can be very emotionally demanding. But when you remember your goal at the end of the day and how far your communities, these communities have come, it can be very, very inspiring. And I think that's the common driver for a lot of us public servants, right? Is that you just work with the thought that you're helping society, even though you might not physically see it, you work with the belief and the hope that at least the next generation, that you're not the only person in your community to enter that table. That you may be the first, but you'll do as much work as you can to make sure that you're not going to be the last.
I'm so grateful that you've joined us from your University of Singapore here. Join me in Winnipeg. Look how far we're joined in this conversation. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ideanomics podcast. We hope it was enjoyable for you, as it was for us. For more anti-racism news, please follow us on our social media channels on Twitter, @IranNetwork_PS, and our LinkedIn, Anti-Racism Ambassadors Network.